This interview is with Pete Tellis, who came to this area in about 1938, I think we'll find on the tape. It was the interview was done at the community center following Rotary on July 8th, 1992. Pete is a Rotarian, and as you will see from the interview, hear from the interview, he came here as a novice forester conservation, soil conservation man, to join in the efforts of stabilizing the then very temperamental sands that were beginning to cover farmland in the Ottawa County area. And through his efforts and all of those involved in the soil conservation district, those sands were stabilized with the forests that we now see out there. So it's an interesting story, interesting interview. We'll pick it up at this point.
TCM board. We are out and town, you only need money. We were trying to get money for TCM and this and that. Here comes Larry Miller, or Larry Daniman along with this idea. I said, this is a great idea. You need that here. And I thought, oh my God, something else, you know. You know Daniman.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Or motivator.
Oh, he sure is, I'll tell you.
And here this darn thing took off and
yeah.
The guy that's, of course, Louis's been doing it in Bush House is the guy.
Yeah.
They were having money, but trouble. You guys, you're handling deeds, you're handling all kinds of stuff. And they didn't have a good, but when they got Ed on there, he straightened a lot of that stuff out.
And being a banker.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
He made a good contribution. And my neighbor, Kuiper.
Yeah.
You know Abe? You don't know Abe, probably.
You know, I don't think I do know him. But is he a builder himself, or?
He's my next door neighbor.
Or he's learned to be a builder.
He was a salesman for one of the glove companies out of territory in a district, and so he loves hammer and saw and all kind of stuff. So he retired young.
Yeah.
So I said, I took him over and introduced him to Larry Dunmore, and I said, this guy should be in this program.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're the one that introduced him to him?
And he's the on-the-job.
Oh, is he?
He's Louis' first lieutenant.
Okay, he's almost the foreman of the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good man. He loves it.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, well, anyway, I don't know what you have in mind. I have no idea. You want to look at the stuff that I have first?
Well, no, not really. You know, what fascinates me about the whole thing... In reading about it and hearing your assessment of it in Glen Eaton's, the sand dunes were gobbling up acres of land out there, almost like a galloping ghost out in the townships. Why was that? Was it an ongoing thing and we just put a halt to an environmental change that had been ongoing for centuries, or was it the logging that had denuded it? What?
This is a very descriptive article on very probably the worst area of sand erosion, wind erosion, mm-hmm. in western Michigan that I knew of. And it took place up in Muskegon County in Sullivan Township, and was known as the Sullivan Sahara. Now, when you have to realize that this soil conservation district here in West Ottawa County consisted of just the seven townships on the west side of the county, and they used these seven townships because the interest was there and the problem was there because of the sand dunes,
mm-hmm.
and the sandy nature of the soil. We had really three types of dunes. You had the primary or four dunes out along Lake Michigan, which are the tall dunes that everybody sees.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have secondary dunes back from that, and then back on some of the some of the plains you had, you even had third dunes that were smaller. Mm-hmm. But very subject to wind erosion. In as much as this was the first soil conservation district east of Mississippi, north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. People came here from all over the United States to study it.
Huh.
It was a new movement in conservation of soil, and it was sponsored by a man, a great motivator by the name of H.H. Bennett, who was a soil scientist with one of the universities, North Carolina, either North Carolina or State or South Carolina, or Clemson, one of the two down there. He's from that area of the country. And of course, they were very badly hit with water erosion down there, tremendous gullies, and just tremendous sheet erosion of all kinds. And that's where the interest really started, with H.H. Bennett. And he was here in Grand Haven, and I met the man, and he talked here when this first started.
This would have been in the 30s then?
Yes, this movement really started in about 35, 34 on a national basis. Well, no one here knew anything about soil erosion in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It was just kind of a thing that crept up on the whole agricultural industry. There were areas, if you can believe it, in the United States where experimental plots, mm-hmm. the university were gradually washing away, and they didn't realize it was happening.
Of course, I remember the stories of the dust storms.
That's right, that was a part of it. This was part of the awakening, with the dust storms in the Southwest, yeah. This was part of it, and we all remember that. But this was happening really all over the United States, and nobody was paying much attention to it.
Well, had it been going on forever and ever and ever?
Oh, sure, ever since farming started here.
Okay.
And so we had to come up with practical tools of controlling it. Farmers, historically, have farmed in straight lines, whether it's up and down hill or cross hill or what.
Sure.
So
it's easier.
And we had to come in with proof of what was happening and so forth. So the Soil Conservation Service was formed within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they set up soil conservation erosion stations in the United States. La Crosse, Wisconsin had one, Zanesville, Ohio had one, and others around in typical areas. And they brought their scientists in, their soils men and their agronomists and their farm management people, and they put on intensive experiments there to really come up with some data that was realistic. And they did this. And while they were doing this then, they brought in young people, young graduates of colleges, and even some older men who had been county agents and that, county agriculture agents and that kind of stuff, into these projects. And they sent us to school for 6 months in these projects. Well, then in order to...
Now, you weren't one of those, were you?
I was one of those guys.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I graduated from high state in 34, there were no jobs. I had a job there at the university, and I could make more money there part-time than I could go out and get a job.
Uh-huh.
So I just stayed on, went into grad school for a while. And so then along in December of 34, somebody came along, they took six of us from the Ag College down there who had graduated down. They said, would you like to go to Zanesville and go to the erosion school? We'll pay you 50 cents an hour and send you to school. You bet. It's a big deal.
50 cents
an hour. That's what we pay. They paid us. And they took us down there and gave us an intensive course in erosion control. and in soils too. Well, then from there, then this thing really began to move. They began to get this data together and show what soil, and it was not only ruining the soil, but ruining the rivers, the lakes, everything else. The old Scioto River system in Ohio was flooding and mud and everything, just terrible. It was a bad change.
But now that was a natural phenomenon, wasn't it? It went on almost like, well, the Nile. The flooding of the Nile each year was a way of life for people.
Yeah, that was part of it, and part of it was caused by the Great Depression, where farmers didn't put anything back into their ground. They just farmed the dickens out of it, every piece they could, you know, and it just brought on this erosion, and if a piece of land got so bad they couldn't farm it, they abandoned it.
And so they destroyed the soil, is what they did.
Yeah, it not only happened here, but it happened all over the United States. Very bad in the south, where you have such heavy rainfall and you have your sandy loam soil down there, just wash like sugar, you know.
Was that true here in Iowa County?
Yes.
Well, what were they growing here? Was it truck farming or?
No,
Christmas trees at that time.
One of the reasons that that we had bad erosion here, originally, when the forests were cleared here, the sandy soils were the easiest to clear.
Yeah.
You see.
Sure.
And so naturally they became the first cleared. They had the white pine on them, the white pine, and of course hardwoods, oaks. But this was also the easiest soil for the farmers to work, the sand, you see. Mm. It was all done with horses.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, and it had some fertility because of the buildup over the years in the forest.
Now it wasn't
some topsoil.
It wasn't the type of sand that you see out on the beach. It was just sandy soil.
It was sandy soil, deep sand. But some had some topsoil had developed because
leaves and
sure. Fine, you could see out there in this 50-year-old plantation that we took the kids to.
Yeah, right.
There's been an inch or two of topsoil built in 50 years there. It was just beach sand when we planted the tree. So it took that long to build an inch or two of topsoil. Uh-huh. So anyway, so they farmed the sandy loam. The sands, they're not even loams. There's no loam in them. So, or very little. So that's what they farmed first. And they raised corn. They raised corn and wheat. Till it wouldn't raise corn and wheat any longer. You know, and they used very little fertilizer on it. And it was an acid soil. And then when it wouldn't raise corn and wheat, they turned to rye, buckwheat. And then it wouldn't raise that anymore. They just abandoned it or showed it to pasture and hoped it would do something. But it didn't do anything.
That was right here.
Oh, you bet. Hundreds of acres of it. And not only these dunes are sporadic. They're not, you know, here's a dune and then to the east of it might be a good piece of ground. Well, not only was it ruining the area of the dunes, but it was blowing over and covering up the good ground that was left on some of the little good ground was left on some of these farms. Mm-hmm. So it was a two-edged sword, really. Mm-hmm. And the areas got so big that if you own 80 acres, 40 of it might be blowing. Well, you didn't have the resources to stop it. You just couldn't do it. So anyway, but getting back to the old process of where this whole thing evolved, along then in 35, in 34 really, I don't know when the 3C camp started, but about that time.
Yeah.
Then somebody came up with the idea, gee, we got a lot of kids that in the cities and everywhere else that need jobs. There's no jobs for them. They're in trouble. And also, the Army, after World War II, had a lot of junior officers that needed jobs.
World War One.
That's right. Yeah. A lot of junior officers that needed jobs. So they came up with this 3C camp idea, that the kids would go out in these areas and mostly on the basis of counties. And they would put 200 of them in a camp. They were paid, as I recall, $30 a month, 25 or 30, but they had to send about 20 of it back to their parents.
Yeah.
The Army had charge of the Army had charge of the discipline, the food, and the housing, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the then the technical staff, of which I was a member, we could go out on private lands, and we could lay out a plan with that farmer. Now, if you'll change this field and farm around the hills rather than up and down the hills, we'll change your fences for you. We'll put fences around the hills to the square, you see. And we'll plant these real bad areas to trees. If you've got big gullies, we'll build dams in the gullies and stop them up. But you have to follow this farming plan to do this. And you furnish the materials, and we'll do the work. So we had crews in the camp. We had foremen, camp foremen, who would take the squad of these boys, about, as I recall, about 30. And I'd make a contract with the farmer, and they'd start to work, and they would do it. And these kids worked. Well, all of us who had an opportunity to work with the camps were rewarded just by having that on, because we learned a lot about people, about kids, and so forth. If you can imagine having 100 boys in one camp, 100 of them from Bloody Breathitt County, Kentucky, with 100 boys from Youngstown and Canton and Cleveland in the same camp, you can imagine how much time we had getting those kids together.
Where was this camp?
At Bethel, Ohio. Huh. And these kids from Kentucky had been in the camp for a year and had never done a thing, never done a lick of work.
Huh.
And so we brought them in there, and my guys, the first few days, I tell you, we wouldn't let them fight in the field, but they could fight when they got off their trucks, when they got back to camp. So boy, they'd pile off those camps and off those trucks, and it would start. Well, now that was a Army job then to take care of that. Yeah. We were through. But those kids got together, and they got to appreciating each other. And it was one of the best work camps, the best bunch of kids to work. The Kentucky kids were very gifted in using the axe and the saw and the shovel, and that's how they were great at it, you know. You didn't have to tell them once how to build a dam, and they'd build it.
Uh-huh.
Or a fence or anything else. And the kids from the cities then, they fell in line, and it was a great camp. And I can remember in the winter, I think it was 37, or the Bethel, 36, had a terrible blizzard right in the middle of the winter over Christmas, and I drew duty during Christmas, and had snowstorms, my gosh, a lot of snow, and those kids got to fighting in the barracks. We just took them out in the field and dumped them off the trucks.
Right out there, all the snow.
Yeah. Then it cooled them off.
That cooled them down.
Cooled them off, and then brought them back. And, but it was a great experience. And I followed, like Glenn has. Glenn followed a lot of these boys.
Uh-huh.
And, a lot of them did very well. Just made men out of them. You also have to remember that the camps were segregated in those days. There were black camps and white camps. They weren't mixed up.
Uh-huh.
And we had veterans camps. Veterans of World War I.
Okay.
And I was in a veterans camp at Lebanon, Ohio. And there were quite a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
We had everything from attorneys to engineers to the fellas down on their luck.
Sure.
Down on their luck.
Depression days.
No, depression days. You couldn't find a job.
Yeah.
And they could come in there and make $30 a month and get their clothes and their food, and they'd send 20 of it home.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get a lot of work out of them the first day or two of the month.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yeah. We didn't count on much. We were lucky to recruit enough truck drivers to to take them to the field. But then after that, well, they'd settle down. And
they're out spending their money. Huh?
Yes, sir, and having a good time. But anyway, they were fine to work with, too, and did a lot of good for those people. A lot of them got on their feet, and after the sure things got better, they went back and got jobs and did very well. Well, that's kind of discussion of the three C's.
Yeah. When did you come here? You came here with the three C's, didn't you?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Oh.
Then in the fall of 1938, I was married and we were living at Lebanon, Ohio, and I was in that veterans camp at that time, and somebody called up and said, would you like to move to Michigan and be a trainee in a soil conservation district? And this is the very beginning of it. They sent, I don't know, six of us from down there up here in these, and the people from Michigan didn't want us very bad, I tell you. We weren't too popular. First, we were from Ohio. And,
yeah.
And second, taking somebody's job.
I bet.
Secondly, that's the second thing was that we were taking somebody's job from Michigan. But that was the first fall we came here in November. And
that would have been 38.
38. Uh-huh. That's right. And I stayed, Mary and I stayed with over across from the armory. They lived across from the army on Franklin. De Glopper.
Oh.
Neil De Glopper and his sister. Uh-huh. Forget her name, but that's where we stayed the first month we were here. And then we moved to stay with Grace and what's her name?
Not Kilbourne.
No. Lived over there by Croyman at the corner of 4th and Franklin. I tell you who they were. They were Stansberry's uncle and aunt.
Warren Stansberry's?
Yeah, Warren Stansberry's uncle and aunt. Grace and I'll think of it before I get through.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, then we stayed with them the rest of the year. Then we moved into a new house on Leggett owned by a lady. And that's where we lived then. Well, the first thing we did when we got here in the fall was to take an economic survey of these farmers in West Ottawa. And that's a copy of it for you. You can have that.
All right. Thank you.
And that is for real. And you can read it. And it'll give you an idea what kind of shape these farms were in out here. Of course, it was a sample. We didn't visit every farm. We didn't have time.
Yeah.
But it's quite enlightening, the situations that these farmers were in. And already, they had commenced to use the farms as a residence and work. This was the very beginning of working off the farm and living in the country.
For these most of the farmers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, I don't know where you want to go into the situation here, trees and whatnot.
But
anyway,
your assessment though is that it all began. Probably the land was more stable until logging, and after logging,
trees on it. Sure, of course.
Sure.
And it began. The very beginning of it was the logging, was mm-hmm. the cutting the trees off,
mm-hmm.
and then people came in here, more and more of them, they had to eat and so forth, and they started farming these sand dunes and the light sands, and they just didn't take care of it, and you started to blow.
Yeah. You know, there are some pictures of Grand Haven taken from Dewey Hill and from other vantage points. No trees.
Well, that's interesting, too.
All around here, they've cut everything down.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether there were trees on Dewey Hill ever or not, I suppose.
Oh, not Dewey Hill, I meant, but looking from Dewey Hill over here.
Oh, over here, yeah.
So you could see Central School sitting over there, not a tree around it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They cut it down. Chopped everything down.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. They did that. They cleared it. But anyhow, In 39, then, see, in spite of all this erosion that was going on, and the need for trees, there were no trees available. Nobody was raising the trees to reforest with.
The little seedlings that you
had
planted.
The seedlings, yeah. Nobody had them.
Uh-huh.
The Michigan State, I think, was supposedly to have nurseries or something that would do that, but when we got really working with this thing and got the farmers interested in it, the landowners interested in it, boy, we needed trees. And in the spring of 39, they said from the whole region of the Soil Conservation Service knew we needed trees here badly, and there were federal nurseries, as I recall, two of them. One of them was at down in Marietta High, a big federal nursery, and they had trees, and some other one, I don't know where it was. But they said, okay, you need trees at Grand Haven, so we'll send you guys trees.
Now, were they pines at that time?
They were pines.
Uh-huh.
But the trees they sent us, they sent them here in boxcars. And, of course, being earlier than we are up here, they started to grow down there before they harvested them out of the nursery.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get them here and get them in a boxcar. And you open the door of the boxcar and the steam would just roll out. They were hot, you see.
Yeah, uh-huh.
They heated. And all we could do was haul them out in the woods and throw them away.
Uh-huh.
I mean, boxcar to boxcar.
Yeah.
They really unloaded their surplus trees on us, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that made everybody unhappy. It had to handle them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and made us more determined then that we had to have a source of our own trees to start with. And if the DNR or the university could catch up with us later, why, okay, but we were going to have trees here. So, that's when a fellow by the name of Lahotsky, who wrote these articles.
I remember you talking to him.
Jay Lahotsky. What
nationality was he?
He was a Czech.
Uh-huh.
And he was a Czech of the old school of forestry. He got his degree in forestry from the University of Prague. And there's a picture.
Yeah, there it is. Uh-huh. Right.
And then he came to the United States and got his doctorate in forestry at University of Michigan. And for his thesis, he interpreted a lot of the German and Holland and French material on dunes at fixation.
Mm.
Put it in
English. In English.
And this
uh-huh.
was his thesis for
his doctorate.
Uh-huh. Yeah, under old Dean Dana at University of Michigan.
Hmm.
And he was just a logical guy to bring over here and put in charge of this whole fixation job that we had, you see. Very, very some fellow, I tell you. He wore the Czech outfit of leggings,
Oh, yeah. With the jumpers, the pantaloons?
You bet.
Yeah, right.
In this color and a purple coat.
Wow.
A little hat. And just like the old European forester.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, in Europe, the old forester was a... He was a very respected man.
Sure.
He was
sure.
A big cheese.
Yeah.
And he got busy, and farmers didn't have any money to buy trees. So Lahotsky said, okay, we'll send over to Czechoslovakia and we'll get seed.
Hmm.
So I think somebody gave us, maybe it was the Board of Supervisors, gave us $700, and he sent over there and he bought Scotch pine seed and white pine, red pine seed, here Austrian. And we would divvy this out to farmers. We'd sell it to them with a package of a quarter or 50 cents.
This is just the seed.
It's the seed, that's right. And then we would go out to the farmer and show him how to have a seed bed, make a seed bed. And maybe you'd have a seabed 20 feet long and 3 feet wide and raise a lot of seedlings in that area.
Sure.
And then we taught them how to transplant them. If you couldn't plant seedlings, two-year-old trees, you couldn't plant them in these dunes. The wind would cut them off.
Oh, yeah.
In the winter, you had to have transplants, bigger trees, you see.
Uh-huh.
And generally, we started planting, first of all, Scotch pine, because they were tough, and the wind didn't hurt them. They had a ton of bark. Tried to get the farmers to plant jack pine, but they would have no...
But now, what's the difference?
Well, jack pine was useless, they thought.
Oh, okay. It was a scrub. Yeah.
But it was the toughest one, but they wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, they liked Scotch pine, and that was all right because they later used them for Christmas trees, you see.
Sure. Yeah.
And red pine, Norway pine, was pretty good against the sand. And those were the three. Well, I can remember that one of the first cooperators we had, Zelenka was one of the first. Old Mr. Zelenka was one of the first cooperators.
Is that right?
In that, you know, the seabed. And Glenn helped him build it. So anyway, one of our first ones up, and I worked in Crockery Township, was Sherm Gleason. Did you ever hear of Sherm Gleason?
No.
Well, he was an old foreman at Bass and Blessing, and he lived out there and had some acreage. And in the spring, after you planted those seeds, they're very subject to what we call dampening off. You water them too much, and the sun comes out, and it stays damp at night, and it affects the cambium layer, and it just kills them.
A mildew?
You have to be very careful. You didn't cover them up too much or leave them out too much. And they always laughed at Sherm because when he's a foreman here, he'd call home and tell his wife, take the covers off. And then in a couple hours, put the covering on. She had a great story about that. But anyhow, he did it. And he very successful at it. And a lot of these trees that you see around here now were raised from those seed beds. The limb, to help the situation, the county came along, the county board of supervisors, and in all their generosity, they gave $1,500 for a nursery.
Huh.
And Frank Garbrick, one of the directors, down at West Alba, said, okay, I got some land out there I'm not using, just use it for a nursery. And it was the right type, of soil, Aranac, as I recall. But then we went out and I told Clarence about this, about the irrigation outfit we bought for $100. And took it down there and put it up, and that's what we irrigated the first nursery with. Was that thing. And we were very successful with this. And I don't know how many 100,000 trees we used here, but a whole lot of them. And this thing went on, and all, they raised trees that way for years, and then the college got in the act, the soil conservation, these federal nurseries got into the act, and we got to the place where if the farmer would buy half the trees, then we'd give him half. Things got a little better, that worked out. But anyway, this is how we built up the interest in trees and how we got so many of them. But then we had another problem here, that you might own 80 acres and 20 acres of it was blow sand. Not only was gone, but it was blowing up and covering up some of your good land.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers didn't have the money to plant or the resources to plant
veggies or what would have
been? Well, this
beach grass is what I.
Well, it really started. There was no beach grass much then either.
Yeah.
And
where did that come from?
Holland or Germany. That's where that originated. Sure. And one of these articles here.
Not this one.
No, here it is. One of them. I'm sure it's in here. Yeah. This is what they started with. Pickets.
Hmm.
In a real bad area.
Oh, sure. Well,
It would be
a barrier type. Yeah,
a barrier. Huh. You slow the wind down.
It looks like it. You know what that reminds me of? The old tank traps during Second World War.
Yeah.
Everywhere throughout France.
But this, of course, was very expensive.
Yeah.
And this is the reason the farmers couldn't do it themselves. So they got what they call an LU project, where the federal government came in, and they would buy that 20 acres from the farmer.
Uh-huh.
And bought it rather cheaply, a lot of it, because it wasn't worth anything.
Was the understanding that once stabilized, they'd sell it back to him?
No. That land was turned over, I think, eventually to the county. Either the county or the district. I don't know which, the Shaw Conservation District. But anyhow, that's after they got this land bought and were buying it, that's when the 3C camp became a necessity. You see, to come in and work on that. And that's the 3C camp then came in 39.
Yeah, we didn't get ours until 39, that's right.
They got to work in 40. Mm-hmm. And they brought a good crew with them. My, they had a good crew. Gordon Walker. Was a superintendent. Glenn was one of them.
Yeah.
Vern Watson was the engineer. Olin Clay, a great foreman. Ed Long, all made good names for themselves around here in this community and the state here. You know.
Uh-huh.
All these men. Gordon did. Gordon went back to Ohio, but it was a good crew and they had a good camp. And then they went. You see, from this, then they went out to this. That's beech grass, you see. Then...
Same idea, only now this is living instead of dead
stuff.
That's
right. Uh-huh. And they plant the trees in here.
Sure.
Now, when we got our nursery, you see, and we got all these seedlings, then we had to transplant the darn thing. Well, we used all jail help and WPA.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And we had used jail help and WPA in that nursery. The 3Cs weren't here. And I don't know. That's what we used. And we had to line these seedlings out in a transplant bed.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very labor consuming, of course. And you don't have too long to do it, really.
Because these things are only about that tall.
Well, right? They're like that.
Uh-huh.
About like that.
You probably have hundreds of them in a bed there.
Oh, a thousand, you know.
Yeah.
And we used planting boards to begin with, and I had some pictures.
Yeah, I remember you showing those.
Yeah, the planting board. That was still slow. So Mahotsky got together with the boys from the Holland Celery Planter people.
Oh.
A very fine company, to see if they couldn't build a planter that would line these trees out mechanically. And and Glenn and I think we're both there, and I had pictures of it, so I did have a, there, I don't know whether it was the three, they have some of them out there, this first trial, when they brought up the first planter, where two people sat on it, and the planter moved along, and they put the trees in a slot, and we had our first mechanical transplant work, shooting work. They kept refining it. And then, instead of planting this beech grass by hand, they got that thing adapted to planting beech grass with that planter, too. Of course, some of it was so rough and bad that they couldn't, and it went from then. Eventually, of course, they developed tree planters to plant the trees in the field, rugged machinery, which they use a lot. But anyhow, the camp came in then and did the planting and the stabilization work and without a doubt, that area that we saw down there, that 50 acres was blue sand, and those trees were planted.
That goes up almost to the war, and then of course the war changed everything, didn't it?
Yeah, by that time the camps were gone.
Yeah,
they needed
the
men.
Yeah.
In the service, and they needed their officers and so forth in the service, And this was a great experience for these young officers, too, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the older men. But anyhow, by that time, we had a lot of soil conservation districts formed. They had to be voted in, you see. Farmers had, the landowners had to vote them in. And
because there was some cost involved. County...
Well, voters. Yeah, not mandatory. The soil conservation districts are legal subdivisions of the state of Michigan, but they have no power to tax. And they're formed expressly for soil conservation purposes. And it provides for the election of officers and terms and all this stuff. And any soil conservation districts can cooperate with any agency that's willing to cooperate with them. Well, of course, the first agency on the job was the Soil Conservation Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They were already working.
Sure. Yeah.
So that personnel then was assigned to soil conservation districts. And we had lots of... Leo Arnold here was a county agricultural agent and a great one, and he went head over heels into this thing and formed this district. I mean, he was a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And his heart was in this thing, and he was in our office every day, and everybody liked him, and he did a job in getting this thing formed. And we had the initial board were a fine bunch. They, Clarence Rangers, and...
he was still doing it in the 50s.
Oh, yeah, 60s, yeah. He was one of the ringleaders to begin with. Frank Garbrick, a fellow by the name of Hunter Herring out in Crockery Township was president of the board. Very capable. He was a supervisor. And a fellow named Hendrick from Grand Haven Township. What was his first name? He was a supervisor out there. And then can't give his name right now, down in Olive Township was on that board. And they were a fine bunch. They really took the thing to heart and worked on it.
Rangers was down that way, Olive.
Yeah.
He was Grand Haven Township.
Grand Haven Township, yeah, sure. Okay. Sure. On Old 31.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
And people came from all over the United States to visit this thing, and this was the seed area for a whole lot of districts in the United States. They all came to see before they went home and formed them.
Mm-hmm.
And some odd things, some interesting things. Up in Crockery Township, there were a couple of landowners up there that had a disagreement over the disappearance of some turkeys. Lejeune and Dixer were their names. I don't know which was the accuser and which was the accused.
Now, where was this again?
Crockery Town.
Oh, Crockery, okay.
And so anyhow, the accuser had a sand dune on the back end of his farm. And the back end of his farm ran right up the building of the buildings of the accused. And north of the sand dune. So this fellow with the sand dune would go out every fall with the spring tooth hair and work up that sand dune good. And it would blow up. It would blow over. And this is an actual picture of that fella's pump around his house. They had to go out in the spring and dig it out before they could say they could
have to look at that.
And he finally ran him back to Chicago. He left. Now I always had that in mind, and so before he died I went out talked to Sherman Gleason to authenticate this, and he said, yeah, I'm both those guys, I know them, and I know exactly what happened. So that, and I had a slide of that one time, but I don't know.
This guy was on the prevailing wind side, and so when the winds began, it would just take all his
sand. Dude, Tommy Beaver. That's kind of a funny. That's interesting. But anyhow, this story of the Sullivan Sahara.
Yeah. Now, is that the same where they have the sewage disposal?
That's right.
Oh, okay.
That's where the water treatment plant is, wastewater treatment plant is for the city of Muskegon. And now it's raising 100 bushel corn to acre.
Yeah, right.
By using the effluent from
that. Sure. Yeah.
But this, and this is a spectacular story. Lahosky wrote this. He put it together.
Huh.
And you could drive literally for miles through that desert.
And how about here? Did we have anything comparable or not?
No. Nothing that I knew of that
yeah.
was comparable to that.
But still, out there in that Grand Haven Township area, I could see where...
Oh, Grand, what's the other township out there by it? Robinson.
Robinson?
Oh,
yeah.
It was
Robinson.
Bad, too.
Yeah.
It was a bad one.
Of course, now, Robinson, there was a lot of marshland out there.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. There's wet sands out there.
Uh-huh.
And, but these... They were dunes, and so, and we did other things with them. We got them to do mining marl for lime and liming and building windbreaks and planting windbreaks and all that kind of stuff was a part of it. And then when I left here in 39, I went to Muskegon County and helped form the North Muskegon district there. I went to Montague, lived there for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, before I left there, they gave me 18 counties across, clear across the state to form new districts in and to set up demonstration farms
uh-huh.
in those counties. So that's what I did until 1948, then I went back to Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Huh. But,
interesting.
Interesting, very interesting career.
So it was that... that foundation that really stabilized the land. But now, when did the Christmas trees, and when did the blueberries, and when did
the blueberries, as I recall, and I didn't have any blueberries. And I worked north of the river. I didn't have any big patches or any that I... And Leo Arnold, the county agent, had a blueberry grove down there sometime, and he was pushing blueberries. This was the really beginning of it in this area. Now, they might have had more of them south of here. I don't know.
Yeah.
Down around Pawpaw and...
Yeah, Grand Junction.
Yeah, Grand Junction.
Yeah, right. Right. That's a bit...
In the sour muck. In the muck down there. They,
okay.
They had them. And Leo then... a lot of this soil that's raising blueberries today was a real problem soil for us back in the day. We didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah,
a lot of fellows spent hours on what they call them, management plans for wet sands and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Now they're growing blueberries.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Back in those days, you couldn't do much with it. But blueberries adapted itself to the mucks and the sour mucks, not the sweet mucks. High water table. And some of the sands, Saugatuck sands and Newton sands that are not productive at all, they adapted them to blueberries.
Yeah. Now, when you say Saugatuck sands, are you talking about a location or is that a style?
That's
a
soil type.
Is it
really? The name of the soil, Saugatuck sand.
Saugatuck sand, huh?
Yeah.
Got its name from Saugatuck, did
it? Yeah,
or?
Probably found it first and named it Saugatuck.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The sand with a hard pan.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you bet.
Now, what is hardpan? Clay?
No, it's iron, mostly leached out of the top and stopped down there.
Huh.
And, all the way from 10 inches, I guess, down. Nothing gets through it. That's your
reason.
It's wet in the spring, you see.
Uh-huh.
Water can't get through it, and then it dries out in the summertime, just dries the bone. They could raise strawberries on it. They raise some strawberries.
Yeah, strawberries will grow in sand, won't they?
Yeah.
Of course, sand will support any number of vegetation.
That was a wonder to us, we fellows that came from Ohio up here. You know.
With good black top soil?
Well, not all. No, a lot of poor soil down there, but there's good soil. But we had loams and clay loams and silt loams and silt, that sort of thing. But the bigger, we raise corn, wheat, mostly. Very few soybeans even in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we got up here and gee, we got into corn and wheat and rye and And what else? Strawberries, currants, raspberries, a lot of small fruit and stuff. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And the wonder to watch is how these fellows up here, these farmers up here, can take a piece of that sand and make a living on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Dewey Chittenden, I remember Dewey Chittenden being out here. And he raised strawberries, 10 acres of strawberries. He said, I can make a living on 10 acres
yeah.
of strawberries.
You could,
they did.
Could back in those
yeah,
days.
Yeah, they did.
Boy, it'd take 10,000 acres today to make those living.
But they did.
Uh-huh. Huh.
And these people here are very, very innovative and great bunch.
Yeah. Today, as you say, the soil that you were working with, it was raw sand back then. Now at least has some topsoil.
Yeah, that's
on it.
Right. They've got to work for you now.
And so when do you finally say, all right, we've won the battle, it's stabilized? Was it stabilized by the time you left in 40, or...?
No.
Yeah.
No, it's been a continuing process. But really, as you drive through this country, you don't see very many empty dunes anymore. I mean, glowing dunes
uh-huh.
anymore. They're going, our real problem today here, Dave, is the management of the woodlots that we have. You see?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Now, the woodlot that we showed the kids down there has been thinned once or twice and needs have to be thinned two or three more times maybe before it reaches its maturity.
Uh-huh.
And some of these woodlots have never been thinned.
And that's not healthy.
No. And we've got a lot of hardwood. And this is the problem here now, is to manage these woodlots that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
We could have beautiful forests here in Western Michigan.
Yeah.
If we were just thin and gorgeous forests. Well, look at Hoffmeister.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have Hoffmeister's thing for it.
Yeah.
But we've got to get over the idea that you can't cut a tree, you know, that you can't thin on this sort of thing.
It's a good point. Yeah.
We've just got to get over that. That's one reason I wanted to work with the schools and start this idea down. Those kids are going to vote on these days. Got all these environmental issues and stuff. But we must thin. Well, people die off and the young ones come on, and that's what we've got to do with these forests. We've got to keep something coming on.
Of course, you know, it's almost the philosophy that got us to the point of lands blowing was a neglect of concern for the environment. And so I suppose the other reverse is to plant it and never touch it so that it'll never happen again.
Yeah.
But your argument is you got to touch it in order to make it work right.
Yeah. And there's no reason why these low sand areas that we planted back in those years, no reason why they can't be producing an income for somebody if we treat it right.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But if we just let them stagnate, why, they're never going to be productive.
Uh-huh.
So there's a whale of a job to be done here in Western Michigan in management, but it isn't spectacular, you see.
Yeah.
It isn't pleasing to the public, but this is a job that really needs, I've talked to Jack about it when he was a commissioner, Jack Smith.
Uh-huh.
But we need to get some projects and take care of these things.
Mm-hmm.
These existing.
Yeah.
I mean, the hardwoods. And some of these days there's going to be a big brouhaha about thinning a Hoffmeister Park. But it needs to be thinned. Mature trees up there should be taken out.
Huh.
And when we start to do that, boy, that's really going to kick up a fuss.
I'm afraid I'd be right there.
Yeah.
I'd be one. I'd say, well, they're taking all the trees out of Hoffmeister.
But it
terrible.
Needs to be thinned and let the young trees come out.
Hmm.
Sure.
Now, when you say the young trees, out there in this, where you had us planting trees, all those trees are about like that. What would they be? 4 to 6 inches?
In the existing plantation?
Yeah,
there?
Right.
No, they were up to 6-8 inches.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that's 20-year-old 20-year growth. Is
no,
that right?
That was planted in 42. That's 50-year growth.
Now, those are the ones that you think take out a third of them. Is that right?
It's going to have to be done.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In order to allow those...
But that's marketable stuff now.
Yeah, sure, it would
it's
be.
It's marketable now, yes.
But for pulp?
Well, some of them are used for logs, for housing, too.
Oh, good.
And some of those early plantations had already been harvested for planks.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, but the ones that were thinned and taken care of early are producing a little lumber, but the most of it's pulpwood. And one of our problems here is that they quit taking pine at Muskegon.
You're
taking hardwood.
For pulp?
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. The finer papers are made. Hardwood. Well, they come up with these chippers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And which are a great thing. You could go out in these woods now and cut down what we call wolf trees. You know, big beeches with branches all over that cover a great big area
right.
Stop everything. No lumber in them.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And hard to cut up into firewood and stuff. But there's choppers on chop those things up in the pulpwood. And
sure.
And then take those things right out of the wood and do it.
Uh-huh.
And that's another reason why we should get in and re-manage these woodlots. So maybe it'll come sometime.
Now... I think I explained to you that I had a friend down in Indiana who dealt in exotic wood or something like that.
Cherry and walnut.
Yeah.
And you bet.
And you explained to me that the growth of trees in this sort of climate produces a more dense wood than down where you might have a growing period of 11 months out of the year or 10 months out of the year.
Yeah. You get down there, for instance, in walnut. Walnut grows like in the floodplain of the, just out of the floodplain, or maybe some of it in a bit, in of the Little Miami River there at Franklin.
Oh, now you okay?
I was managing a farm there, and it had some walnut down in there. I had trouble selling it because it had grown so fast. And the grain, you know, the rings were far apart.
Uh-huh.
What do we call it?
Yeah, rings are all in the
well. Room. There's another name. Grain. The grain was, it was coarse grain.
Uh-huh.
Well, when you run that through the dry kiln, it shrinks. It shrinks so bad. See there, it's like trying to dry kiln hickory.
Mm-hmm.
Hickory's a beautiful wood, but when you put it in a kiln to dry it, you don't know what you're going to get when it comes out, because it's a wide grain. A little ash is a little the same way, but the walnut here should be quite valuable in cherry, because it does grow so you got a slower growing season.
Yeah, okay. So the rings are closer to
it. Yeah,
closer.
Sure they are.
Yeah.
It takes longer to grow it here.
Uh-huh.
It's sure. More
Well.
Now, Dave, you can have this. If you publish...
All of it?
Sure.
Oh, good.
They made me a copy of this. See,
the
first thing I did when I moved back up here was to find that thing.
This?
Yeah, I looked, and Larry thought he had it, and so on, but that girl out of the Soil Conservation District looked and looked. She says, I know it's here, and she dug it up. So we made copies of it, and... I think there's a copy in the county agent's office, and the county and the district has a copy, and you have a copy if you ever want to use it. Now, that's authentic stuff. I mean, if you use that, you would want to refer to it, of course.
Sure.
And if you use any of this fellow's work, Lahotsky's work, you would want to give him
credit.
You do that.
Yeah.
And you want to read this, because this is in
the Sahara Desert, or the Sullivan Sahara.
Yeah. Great. And I sent down my sister-in-law. He's dead.
Uh-huh.
He went from here to be, then in the Army. Then he went and he started the forestry department at Clemson University.
Oh, yeah.
And he was quite successful. and made a name for himself.
You told me that he's the one that told you how high to plant the stakes, or how, and then he put a tree here, and
yeah,
and he had the wind pattern figured out.
Yeah, too. And he was. There are very few people that I ever went into a forest with, or a woodlot, or two of them in my time that I've been out with, that could really make a forest talk and tell you what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. He could take a bunch of kids, a bunch of Boy Scouts or something, and go into a woods and really relate what was going on. And not many fellows can do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you do it. You do it very well.
Gibbs could do it. The old forester from Connecticut that was the regional forester, Gibbs could do it. And Mahosky could do it. They did a marvelous job of it. And he trained some of the better foresters in the South, came out of Clemson. But anyhow, if you do that, his widow, yeah. Mary's sister, is still is living.
Mary's sister? You're married?
Yeah.
Is her married?
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, when we moved here, when we rented the house on Leggett, we had an extra room. And Lahosky was a bachelor at that time. And when Sally was born, Mary's sister was a nurse. And she came up from Ohio to take care of Mary, and she met Lahosky, and they got married.
I'll be there. So there's a good connection there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So we were always close.
And what's her name? Is it anywhere in here?
No, her name is Josephine Lahosky.
What was your wife's maiden name?
Mary.
But, I mean, her maiden.
Oh, Beals.
Beals.
B-E-A-L-S, yeah.
Let's see.
And, he was quite young. Very, very opinionated, of course, and if you disagreed with him professionally, you disagreed with him personally. That's the way it was. So he had a lot of fellows that didn't appreciate him.
Uh-huh.
But he knew what he was talking about, and he stuck with it.
Sure.
But
was he Austrian or Czech?
He's Czech.
Okay.
He's Czech. His people were all killed during the Nazi regime.
Uh-huh.
He lost all of them.
Huh.
But he seemed to some guy.
Is he Jewish?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I never knew. But I don't. It sounds Jewish, doesn't it?
Well, it could be. Lahosky to me is.
He was Lutheran.
Okay.
So I don't think he was.
Uh huh.
About back in the family, he probably was.
Well, when you said his family was killed, I wondered if they were exterminated.
Yeah, that's a Jewish name.
Perhaps that's it.
Yeah.
Sure.
And he had no use for him, so I don't know.
With the Nazis, I don't blame you.
No, anyhow.
Can I take this, too?
Sure, you can take it off.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
all right. Appreciate it. Well, this will give me a good chapter to go on.
Now, you write another book?
Trying to,
yeah.
I'm going to take the history of Grand Haven from 1890 up to the present time.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. But see, here's 50 years.
Yeah, that's right.
When I say 50 years, we didn't take it beyond. But if you just know that the land that we're dealing with, at least we know where it all began back in the
30s. Yeah, yeah. And
that's kind of frightening when you think if you're going to write a period of 100 years and already you've got 50 of it right here sitting here.
Yeah.
You know
that? Hey, is that still on?
Yeah, I can turn it off. Don't you?
Yeah.